This interview with Professor Gregor Morfill is part of the Jodcast. For the full show, go to www.jodcast.net.
The question of whether life is unique to planet Earth, or if it abounds in the universe, has vexed astronomers, biologists, physicists, cosmologists, and philosophers for decades. Now, a group of physicists have discovered that dust particles in a plasma can form complicated structures capable of self-replication and adaptation. The results challenge our concept of life itself. I spoke by phone with Professor Gregor Morfill, one of the directors of the Max Planck Institute for Extraterrestrial Physics in Germany.
What we studied was to identify equilibrium structures of small dust particles that are strongly interacting. So this goes back to a discovery we made in 1994 when we found out experimentally this time that plasmas, which is regarded as the most disordered state of matter, that plasmas under certain conditions can also be very regular, very ordered, crystalline or liquid structures. So since then, ourselves plus over 100 groups worldwide have taken up this research and have started to investigate the properties of this new state of matter. That's basically where we started from. And the result that you are particularly interested in was in part experimental, in part theoretical, to identify what are the equilibrium structures that these particles take up in free space when external forces are as small as possible, so there's not much of a perturbation.
You're essentially looking at the physics of dust. Yes. in a plasma.
Charged dust particles in a plasma in the state where they're sufficiently close together that they can feel the forces from their neighbors, the electrostatic forces from their neighbors.
Okay, all right. Well, let's start off with what do we mean by a plasma. Now, we quite often hear that a plasma is the fourth state of matter. Mm-hmm. Well, can you explain a little bit more what a plasma is?
Okay, a plasma consists of charged particles, positive ions and negative electrons, and usually the reason why they're called the fourth state of matter is as you increase the temperature of ordinary matter, you go from solid to liquid to vapor or gas, and then as the atoms dissociate into their constituents of electrons and ions into a plasma. Basically what a plasma is, it's the most disordered and usually also the hottest state that matter is in, like the sun is a ball of plasma to all intents and purposes. But they're also called plasmas. They're used in industrial manufacturing of chips and plasma vapor deposition in making flat screens and so on. So plasmas are basically everywhere. Most of the visible universe is made of plasmas, and it's a very ubiquitous and very interesting state where because of the electric charges, interactions with magnetic fields are very important, and because it's so ubiquitous, comes in so many forms and shapes, it's one of the big areas of study, not least of them being the plasma fusion program, which is trying to replicate the processes that make energy on the sun.
As a power source for us, isn't
it? As a power source, yes.
So is it, as plasma is one of these ubiquitous properties of the universe, we also know that dust is pretty much everywhere in the universe. It's an important component.
That is true.
So I suppose the connection between how does dust behave in a plasma has a very strong astrophysical set of implications, I should think.
Absolutely. You wouldn't have planets like the Earth if you didn't have dust in the universe that was able, during the process of star formation, to form the little blobs that circle around the stars, the terrestrial-type planets. Also, when you're looking at interstellar clouds, these are called dark clouds to some extent because they're so full of tiny little dust particles that cut out the light from the stars beyond them, and so they appear dark. And they make up, in our own galaxy, in the Milky Way, something like 10% or so of the total mass. Most of it is in stars, of course.
Right. So let's return to specifically your research. You're looking again at the physics of this dust in the plasma. First of all, what's the dust? What is the dust? What's it made of?
Could be anything. The for our laboratory experiments, of course, we want to have very controlled conditions. So we choose particles that are all as much as possible of the same size with a very small size variation. And these are ones that you can buy commercially, are usually plastic particles, or they can be metal coated. The most commonly used type of particle is what's called melamine formaldehyde, so these are just polymer particles.
How do they compare to dust particles that we presume exist in these dark clouds in space?
We know from the infrared signatures that there is a lot of ice that has condensed out onto small particles, and we know that most of the heavy elements should end up in the form of tiny dust particles. So once you know what the cosmic abundance is of the different elements above hydrogen and helium, then that's basically what makes up the composition of the dust particles in outer space.
Now, your research started off presumably with a touch of theory, looking at how dust particles could interact with each other, how they're attracted and how they could possibly sit next to each other in specific shapes. You talked about equilibrium states. Can you explain that a little bit more,
please? Okay, the original theory, the very earliest paper on that was by a guy called Ikesi, and he speculated in physics of fluids that if you brought charged dust particles to a sufficiently high density, that they could spontaneously self-organize to form crystalline states. And I was very interested in that at the time, started to work on that. This was just pure theory. Realized that that this theory was incomplete, and started to improve things until I got convinced, yes, it should actually happen. And then next thing that I wanted to do, being a theoretician, I didn't want to do experiments myself. So I talked to some colleagues and explained what I wanted, and they all said, oh, forget it, this is only theory and it's too adventurous. We have more important things to do. And so eventually I decided, okay, if I really want to find out and nobody wants to do this experiment for me, I have to do it myself. And then you do what you always do. You pick the cheapest path possible, and that means you persuade a PhD student and you try and borrow some equipment from somewhere, and that's exactly what I did. So there's a colleague in Cologne who had some equipment in a laboratory that he was going to scrap, and I asked him, could we have it for a day or a year or 2 years, whatever it took, and then I was really very, very fortunate with the PhD student. The guy, his name is Hubertus Thomas, and he's an absolutely gifted experimentalist. And I asked him if he would be interested in doing such a long-shot experiment, and he thought about it for a while, and then he said, yeah, why not?
Brave man.
Brave man. I told him, okay, the probability that it'll work is tiny. The importance, if it does work and we discover it, is large. The product is finite. So what do you think? And it didn't take long for him to say, okay, why not? And so an interesting story, he called me up one day. Oh, no, he sent me a letter saying that, well, according to this theory that he's now worked through, we should be getting these crystalline plasma, these plasma crystals all the time, and there must be something wrong. And while I was still pondering that, he called me up and said, oh, come to the lab immediately. we could see that it was working, and since then we published that. There's a really rather nice article that Sir John Maddox, who was editor of Nature at that time, wrote about this discovery, because we didn't publish it in Nature. That really led to an incredible development with exponential growth in this field. You know, the advantage is you can really look at these systems in slow motion, because the particles are so heavy, the timescales are stretched, what is normally in atoms in the order of 10 megahertz or so, in these systems is 100 hertz. And the particles are bigger. You can see each individual one with a CCD camera. You can follow all the critical processes that normally you can't see, like what happens during the details when something melts or condenses and so on. You can follow all that very easily. Plus, you can investigate what happens at the limit of cooperative behavior when you really go to smaller and smaller nanosystems. You can see the individual particles behaving differently depending on where you are. So there's a huge area where I think physics will be improved, or where we know the processes better by having such new techniques in hand. Mm-hmm. That's part of the interest in doing this. The other part is that, of course, these complex plasmas, as they're called, with the tiny microparticles inside, they represent the plasma state of soft matter. And soft matter, that includes emulsions, colloids, sponges, polymers, and so on, in the solid and liquid states. And it was really not thought possible at the time that there could be a plasma state of soft matter.
Right.
And
is this because a plasma, by its very nature, is a hot, disordered, angry thing?
It's disordered, and soft matter has to have certain properties. You have to be able, using external forces, to organize the structures inside. You have to have this extreme compressibility and expansion back to its original state, and so on. So, you know, they're a special kind of supramolecular system, and it's also commercially very important.
Right. Now, there's an important point that you mentioned, that this sort of soft matter, or this kind of matter, the soft matter, requires external forces to become organized in some way. But these shapes, these formations of dust in the plasmas that you're studying, they're self-organizing. They organize themselves into these very unique shapes. Tell us a little bit about these specific shapes that you've discovered.
Okay. In the laboratory, of course, where gravity plays an important role, the shape is determined by the external forces. This is if you take a glass of water, the water adjusts to its external shape and the fact that gravity is there. In free space, a drop of water would be spherical, and it would be held together by surface tension. So this is a force that it essentially makes itself. Now, these complex plasmas on Earth, similar, of course, the microparticles are very heavy, so gravity plays an important role. In space, which is where we have an experiment since 2001 on the International Space Station, we can observe these things under much less perturbed conditions, and so we can learn a lot more about the processes that do not require so much energy or forces to perturb things. And then using numerical techniques, numerical simulations, to go on from what we've learned from Earth, from space experiments, to a situation which is completely free of surrounding influences, you can then make that step with a fair degree of confidence, and you can calculate what kind of structures these things would self-organize into. The interesting thing there is that, of course, these particles in a plasma all carry usually a negative charge, unless photo effect plays a role. So let's just ignore photo effect for the moment and say we only have negative particles. They should really repel each other. So
yes.
There should be no equilibrium state, naively thinking. When you do the full theory, you realize what you actually have is a dissipative system, where plasma particles attach themselves to the small microparticles. So when an ion hits it, it gets one positive charge element. When an electron hits it, a negative one. And then the two recombine on the surface. So the plasma has to be resupplied from the outside. So you can imagine you have a huge cloud of these small particles. There's constantly plasma flowing in to replenish what is being removed on the inside by the interactions there. And this flow of plasma from the outside, of course, acts like a self-confinement, so it compresses the cloud and has a very similar role as the surface tension does. And that's why you end up, even in outer space, with particles of the same type, you end up getting self-confinement and structure formation. And that's an essential element of dissipative systems, of course.
So it's remarkable that these dust particles, all with a similar charge, they actually can sit next to each other quite happily without constantly pushing themselves away.
Well, that's only possible because there's an attractive component in the interaction as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that is provided by the flow of the ion and electron plasma in the system. For instance, another important aspect would be shadowing. This is a little bit like the cyclists at the Tour de France, whether they're doped or not. They like to be in the shadow of the person in front so that they don't have to do so much work. It's quite well known in hydrodynamics as the Bernoulli effect. It also works in plasmas. If you have two particles very close to one another, the surrounding plasma will hit the one next to it, but there will be a shadow from the particle, from the neighbor particle on the original one, so that there's a force actually attracting them in spite of the fact that the electric force will repel. And then it's just a question, where does one or the other force become more important? And when you work all these things out, it turns out that there is actually an attractive component to the interaction between two particles like that.
It's fantastic. So that at some point, these two little particles, if we're just considering two particles at the moment, there will be a point in space where the attractive force and the repulsive force cancel out and the two particles can be, in some sense, joined.
That's the equilibrium position. So the particles, of course, they are some distance apart. And in our lab experiments, the distance between the particles where they come to equilibrium is about 50 to 100 times as far away as the particle size themselves. You can illuminate the particles in different layers, and you can scan right through such a cloud and calculate or measure the structure that these particles have.
And what do these structures look like?
Different. In the laboratory experiments, for instance, we can get crystalline structures with the standard crystalline forms that are also observed in ordinary matter. We can have the body-centered cubic or face-centered cubic or hexagonal close-packed and so on. This depends a little bit on the conditions that are chosen for the experiments, but these are all the standard crystalline structures that we can have. In space, in the simulations, in addition, it turns out that what seems to be a fairly nice equilibrium structure that develops is the helical structure, or the double helix even.
Now, this is something which has caused a lot of interest around the world, of course. And that is, when we start talking about double helixes, we instantly think about DNA, which is the,
yes,
encoding of life as we understand it. And, of course, if we start talking about double helices of dust in space, we start shouting aliens. So please tell us what your thoughts are on this.
Okay, I think that's too simplistic way, simply because you have a double helix. I mean, we can manufacture these on Earth, but we wouldn't call these structures that we manufacture then aliens. The interesting thing from my point of view is that these kind of structures occur quite naturally and spontaneously with quite elementary forces, electrostatic forces. And there's always been this argument about making complex molecules like the DNA structures that have these particular bindings that allow the encoding of information, that this, if it's done randomly, would take longer than the age of the universe, and therefore life couldn't exist. So there has to be some thought behind it. If the production of such structures are just a normal equilibrium process due to the well-known forces that are acting. And if the system always would like to go into this kind of a structure simply because that's what the equilibrium does, then I think this is an important message that says, hey, it's not such a rare occurrence, and it's something where you don't need to invoke statistics, because nature has a better way of doing it, and it's just one of the fundamental principles of trying to get to its equilibrium state.
It's quite possible for a set of particles naturally to be in these extremely complicated states. It's not particularly unlikely. It's actually quite possible.
It's not only not unlikely, it's it's also the preferred state. And that, I think, is an important finding. It's corroborated to some extent by some experiments that were done in Moscow at liquid helium temperatures, where one actually observed these helical structures in particle distributions in the laboratory as well. There are other instances too. For instance, in supercooled ions in storage rings, when you look at the structures of these particles there, it's also helical. So, you know, it really does seem as though there's nothing magical about the helix. The magic is in this storing of information in such systems and in making it available to a reproduction of some kind.
That's the important point that we should talk about now, is the fact that there is something important about these shapes, and it is this ability of them to self-replicate. Now, my biology is pretty poor, but what I can remember is the way that the double helix DNA molecule replicates itself is it basically unzips the two helices apart and basically become two more separate copies. How do your structures, the structures that you theorize, replicate themselves?
I think it's more, it's not like unzipping the helix in the same sense. There are two ways of doing this. One is to, of course, develop a third helix around it, and then, like changing dancing partners, you suddenly end up having different strings together. This would be one simple way of doing it. It's just a question of where is the bond stronger at the time. The other way would be for the system to simply snip off and divide at some point and make two sub-helices that can then continue to grow by addition of more particles.
Another important issue is adaptation. We know that natural selection likes the idea of occasionally mixing things up, gene swapping, and fitter forms of life adapting to their environment, etc., and therefore procreating. Do you see any evidence or channel or possibility for these sort of shapes to adapt to their environment?
I think they will always adapt. If the environment changes, then the equilibrium state that they are searching for will have to adapt to that. So I think from the physical point of view, there's nothing amazing about that. From the point of view of you know, what constitutes life and or life as we know it, I think there's an issue here of time scales. I've been thinking about that a little bit, sort of on and off, and I think if this paper leads to sort of discussions where you get replication of wine glasses in front of you amongst people, I think this will be very good. The point here is, for instance, if you imagine a life form that lives forever, does it have to replicate? Not necessarily. Does it have to change to with respect to changes in its environment? Definitely yes, because that could be threatening. So I think the question about what constitutes life and what doesn't is at the moment a question of definition by experts, and they're doing whatever they can to minimize everything to a sufficient number of conditions, and from that you get a sort of kind of blueprint or definition what would constitute life.
So you've opened up an interesting debate about what is life, what do we mean by life?
And since this is only a definition, that the experts so far have come to and have made and so on, they can be changed.
Of course.
Whereas the systems that you can study in are systems that underlie certain principles, chemical or physical properties that we just have to come to terms with. And then, to some extent, it's a question where the experts will have to say, well, do we regard something like this as life? Okay, maybe it fulfills all the requirements that we've laid down so far. Maybe we should add another one. So, you know, when I think about it, we have two questions here. It seems that the big self-organized, strongly interacting clouds of dusty plasma certainly appear to have all the characteristics of what are currently believed to be the necessary and sufficient conditions for defining life. And I was disturbed by that, I must say. I don't like the thought, quite frankly, of a bunch of dust particles being alive. We've all come to accept that a bunch of lifeless atoms can somehow combine to produce life. And here, the step would be we would have to accept that a bunch of lifeless supramolecular particles can also somehow combine and produce a different form of life, maybe very primitive or whatever, but according to the definitions, acceptable. I personally have a bellyache about that. to me, it's too alien, too far away, and maybe we should just use this to make sure that what we believe are necessary and sufficient requirements for life should be evaluated again in the face of this thing.
There was a point made in the article that it might be possible to detect these structures in dark clouds using the Spitzer Space Telescope.
Okay, the important issue is you have to be able to look into the dark clouds, which means using infrared or radio. The scales of these systems, they should have a characteristic scale simply because the particle separation needs to be of a certain order, otherwise they don't see one another. Then, in order to see something, because these clouds are so many parsecs away, kiloparsecs, sometimes hundreds of parsecs, you would need to have sufficiently large structures because they would then emit some kind of a coherent radiation from their own interactions, from their own vibrations and so on. And that's what one would have to look for. In principle, at least, one can say yes. If those things exist, then like any regular structure, they will have regular waveforms that will modulate any emission, and that should be visible.
Sounds exciting. We look forward to predictions about what we'll be able to see with astronomical instruments, see whether these structures do actually exist.
Well, we hope that some of the experts who are actually working on these astronomical observation programs that and they understand the tools better than we do, and that they will start looking into what it is that would be visible and would help in identifying exactly how big these things would have to be and what kind of signature to look forward to, what time scales, what frequencies.
Thank you very, very much indeed.
Well, it's a pleasure.